you got something you would like to...
Okay.
Well, he invited me to the comedy.
Yes, he invited me to that. Subject matter, tempo, everything is at your pace and choice.
But are you going to be asking questions?
Yeah. Yeah.
Look at that.
Yeah.
No sheet of paper. You're
upset. I think it's more like an interview if I'm going, Luna did that. Whereas I think a conversation is better because then you're around. It's not like I'm saying, you have to remember that thing.
I must call Marcus Fern actually, see what's happened to that DVD. But it was exactly in this room, so I knew how cold it was going to be.
I wish we had.
What?
I wish we had.
Well, I have taken precautions underneath. Not enough, but some.
I think we're looking at this, so maybe it's just turned out.
Yeah, maybe it's just turned off.
Yeah.
is why I talk. So I did.
It was a while back. Did you Soho Theatre?
I did twice at Jermyn Street Theatre.
Yeah.
2 years running. Did but that was through Sam that started running conventions there.
Can I see that person yet? What's that?
Westminster Hall with dealers and assigning.
Central Hall, 2 months or something.
Yeah.
He used me as a guinea pig to see if talks would work. I don't know what conclusion he's come to.
Sure, I just need to take
Don't worry.
What are you doing, Toby?
Having a little bit of salad, because I've been on the go all day.
Oh, gosh.
That sustenance.
Just round the corner, just go walk through the...
So you just converse and we can cut it at any point. Oh, you mean to the village? Oh, sorry. Well, right now, it's fair.
I just wondered whether legs and feet were in, whether... What? Knees are in.
And they only do that for beginning and end, and then they close in.
I think the way that Kendall Rimbus encouraging us to think is that things have their, once they're produced, they cannot but change. All they can do is change. They cannot stay the same. So that's the message as far as he's concerned. But it's just that the change is in the case of a very sort of rigid and sort of phenomena with a rigid sort of structure or something like baked clay, diamond or something, then the changes are not obvious. But when you use this reasoning of if it's produced, it must be impermanent, it leads you to the conclusion that anything, you know, right from the very point of its production is disintegrating. It's disintegrating in the sense of falling away from what it was. Whatever tiny moment you have, if from the beginning of that moment to the end of the moment, change will have taken place. Yeah, so it persists, it lasts, but it only lasts by changing every moment. Yeah. It doesn't last without changing, yes. So the new moment arises, very similar to the previous moment. So that for somebody who's just looking with ordinary eyes, then the second moment looks very similar to the first moment. So it seems to be the same, but that's, Ken Marimpa saying that's a confusion. It may be similar, but it's not the same. So yes, the pot lasts for 3,000 years, but only by changing all the time. So that's his teaching. Yes, David?
Can you maybe invite us to discuss? I think you mentioned that it needs three or possibly four things to sort of focus on. One was the cause and effect. One was the permanence. The other one was the impermanence. But there was the one thing that we haven't really discussed much, another thing which you mentioned, which is what is it that makes things change more?
Well, that sounds like what these people were discussing, doesn't it?
Well, I think that might be something that we haven't discussed much that could be sort of quite important thing that kind of makes all of this
Yeah. So definitely through things, interaction, then they cause each other to change. Yeah? They bring about, yeah, they have effects on each other, don't they? So the impact upon each other. But then they're saying that beyond that, the thing, once it's produced, it's only produced in the nature of something that is, you know, going to change. Just from its own nature, that's its nature then. The nature of the thing that's produced is just as something that is just moment by moment changing, disintegrating. So it doesn't need somebody to come along and scratch the cup or somebody to come along and chip it for it to change. It's just, that's the only way it can exist as something which is just completely changing, renewing in each moment. So there's two angles.
Due to the interactions that it has with other things that exist, right?
Yeah.
And so it's that kind of interdependence that I find quite interesting, and because that sort of, kind of brings you to, how our the way we as humans tend to develop psychologically in a way as well. We, we're born needy, and from the milk that we want from our mother, that you tend to get this repetitive kind of self-gratification thing that, and that's quite natural. It's sort of part of, the interdependence of everything, and we're a product of that ourselves, and the way we think is a product of that.
Yeah. So, the implications for, impermanence for the way we are and the way we should think about life and the way things, the implications for it, for our, path, practice of the path, That's something we want to come on to now. But just, it's saying here, see, again, remember, reasoning refutes a cause of disintegration, which is a separate object. By the cause of being created alone, something necessarily disintegrates. Thus, from merely having been created, it necessarily disintegrates by itself. Yeah. So we're not. Yeah, I plundered about this for a long time, you see. So what about the man who comes along with a hammer and smashes the pot, then? But here he's talking about the subtle disintegration from moment to moment. The gross disintegration? Yeah, we can say external causes come in and play their part and, you know, assist the final disintegration or, you know, the sort of the chipping or the cracking. Sorry? Hmm. Yeah, it's just the process in some phenomena, some objects are going on much slower than others, you know, like you make a piece of bread and it goes moldy and, you know, it's inedible within a few days, or the flower blooms and fades. But a diamond might take millions of years to disintegrate, but eventually it will, without having to be sort of smashed by a hammer, it seems. So at this point, somebody says, Master Lotan, he's one of these old Indian masters like Dharmakirti. At this point, Master Lotan explains with an example. If you shoot an arrow into the sky, it needs effort to shoot it upwards, but it needs none for it to fall back down. So we make effort to make for the pot to come into creation, but from then it's just, it's disintegrating. It doesn't need any further cause to make it disintegrate. It is in that state of passing away just through having been made. So the falling back down does not need any additional effort separate from the shooting upwards. It falls back down by itself. So something ceasing does not need a cause separate from its being brought into creation. It disintegrates by itself. But it's saying that's the subtle disintegration. You see. I think for the gross disintegration, like the pot smashing or the, you know, getting chipped or cracked or something, then it's... external causes certainly can come in. You know, so like creation and disintegration, like just they're always happening both at the same time. It seems like they should be fundamentally opposite, but no, he says you've got to see them as being just same nature, just like emptiness and dependent arising. Well, perhaps we should start going on to the next section, really, contaminated phenomena of suffering. I think we should do some more meditation on impermanence, because it's sort of, you know, we just need to work at it a bit to get it some more coming to our minds, sort of the sort of subtler levels of it. It's you don't just sort of acquaint yourself with it in just a little bit of study. You just sort of be able to practice at it and get it sort of. Yeah, sort of familiarize, and this is very important. But then, all contaminated phenomena are suffering, you see. This is the second of the four seals, flowing from the first. They're all supposed to have one flows to the next, you see. So, not necessarily that each one is the cause of the next one, but, you know, there's very much a relationship between them. So, can you turn to the text where it says all contaminated phenomena are suffering? Section 2. On my page, it's page bottom of page 21, but I'm not sure you've got the same printing. Yeah, in square brackets, good, yeah, 363. Now we'll read the verse at the end of the impermanent section. Oh my, compounded things disintegrate from merely being created. It's their way. Oh fool, not understood yet. Hoodwinked by the demon, permanent grasping are we. So permanent grasping is causing a demon. There's a lot of trouble, a lot of suffering. It's coming from that. So contaminated phenomena of suffering. With regard to that, there are two. The actual in the elimination of doubts. So the actual with regard to that, with regard to the first, in many sutras it says, compounded things are all impermanent, and what's impermanent is suffering. So thus the import of the scriptures is that we should infer impermanence from the sign product and suffering from the sign impermanent. And the commentary on Valley Cognition says, thus from the suffering from impermanence and from suffering selflessness, it says. So then, you know, if we were going to go on to do the other two seals, then what's the relationship between suffering and selflessness? Not exactly a causal relationship, but, you know, opposing the predicament of suffering with the understanding of selflessness. The better you understand the predicament of our suffering, the more you will be determined to, you know, find out why that's happening and apply the antidote. Is the meditation on selflessness. So just to give another quotation from the sutras on the way Buddha's exhorting his listeners. You know, Buddha's teaching the Four Noble Truths, he's teaching impermanence, suffering and selflessness. And so in this particular teaching it concludes, considering this, O bhikshus, a learned, noble hearer of the word becomes weary of body, weary of sensation, weary of perception, weary of the samskaras, weary of consciousness. So that's the five aggregates. We might say form, or I'm used to saying form, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness. But he's saying body, sensation, perception, samskaras, consciousness. So it's just a different translation of the five aggregates. Becoming weary of all that, he divests himself of passion. By absence of passion, he is made free. When he is free, he becomes aware that he is free. And he realizes that rebirth is exhausted, that holiness is completed, that duty is fulfilled, and that there is no further return to this world. Or in another concluding paragraph, again he's talked about impermanent suffering. So he says, seeing this, a well-taught, noble disciple becomes disenchanted with pleasant feeling, disenchanted with painful feeling, disenchanted with neither painful nor pleasant feeling. Being disenchanted, he becomes dispassionate. Through dispassion, his mind is liberated. When it is liberated, there comes the knowledge, it is liberated. He understands, birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. So this is Buddha's kind of quite radical solution. You see, you've got to be done with, even with birth. Rebirth is exhausted in that first quotation. Second one, birth is destroyed. There is no more coming to any state of being. There's no further return to this world. So, this determination to forsake the world. So, if we have the correct realization of the suffering nature of our existence here, then we are developing this attitude of renunciation, which is, you know, the point at which we enter the path. If we are in the sort of the vehicle, the individual liberation vehicle. Of course we need compassion, bodhicitta, to enter the path of Mahayana path, but we won't have that until we've had this development of renunciation first. So that's quite a serious, conclusion to come to, isn't it? And how do we get to that conclusion? How do we reach the conclusion that the things that we are, involved with in this world are, it's better to put them aside and strive for our happiness elsewhere? Well, one of the key meditations or key reasons why we should see things as suffering is because they're all impermanent. So then, that's the question that Kenma Rinpoche's investigating here then. So then, what is the suffering that is to be known by way of impermanence? And what is the way to know it? With regard to that, there are two. Identifying the suffering which is to be known and the way to know it. Very methodical. So number one, identifying the suffering which is to be known. So again, he's got a commentary from a comment from the commentary on valid cognition, which I'm sure you all know is written by Dharmakirti now. So the texts that try to follow the logical path, the reasoning path, to understand these things, very much relied upon as a text by Dharmakirti. So when meditate on suffering is said, then compositional suffering is meant. So Buddha's the one telling us to meditate on suffering, driving our, you know, driving us forward onto this sort of, you know, the spiritual path to eliminate it altogether. First of all, we have to know what it is, we have to feel it strongly instead of just being rather dull about it and full of misgraspings and fallacious ideas. So meditate on suffering is said by the Buddha. So when he said that, he meant, or you know, at the subtlest level, you should meditate on the compositional suffering. That is, the suffering the suffering that we are told to meditate on, or know, by way of impermanence, is compositional suffering. The reason is from the fact that the two, the feeling of suffering and the suffering of change, are known even by animals and by outsiders, respectively. So it is not necessary to know them by way of subtle impermanence. So he's really trying to give us his lowdown on this, you know, the subtlest suffering, the subtlest impermanence. So there's this one division of suffering into three, isn't there? Do you know which division of three he's referring to here? You've had teachings on suffering a bit before, different divisions of suffering. You've heard of them, Jane, have you? Suffering of suffering is number one, which you can see, actually, again, Rinpoche called the feeling of suffering. But I think that means a common feeling of suffering, what people would generally, you know, say, I'm suffering now, that sort of gross feeling of suffering, that's the grossest level. And, you know, he says that's known even by animals. Of course, it's known by us, it's known by outsiders, but it's also even known by animals. So you don't need to meditate. You know, just to identify that. It doesn't mean you shouldn't meditate on it to familiarize yourself, remind yourself of it. You know, there are many meditations in, you know, the treatise on the path to enlightenment about meditating also on gross suffering. But you don't need an understanding of subtle impermanence to be able to meditate on that. And then the suffering of change. So that's the second one, suffering of suffering, gross suffering that you know is the broken legs and the sort of grief and sorrow and you know troubled emotions that we all recognise as suffering, and the suffering of change. So this one is sort of sorry condition that even the happy states of feeling and experience in samsara, they turn out to be, they're always going to let us down. Impermanence in the sense that they are going to come to the end of their continuum. Yeah. So here we can think of continuum of the similar type sort of thing, you know. So for a while you'll have a feeling of happiness,
For a while you have a healthy, strong body, maybe, if you're lucky. You know, for a while you have freedom and leisure and kind of, you know, nice sunshine or tasty ice creams or whatever. But then whatever pleasure it is in this round of samsara, then it's always going to kind of let us down. It's always going to, you know, come to the end of its continuum. So the obvious change is the suffering of death, but, you know, old age, illness, and, you know, other kind of more sort of less, or slightly less catastrophic events. But, you know, it's all the happiness of samsara can therefore be called the suffering of change, because it's always going to break down on us. But that's known also by outsiders. You don't have to be, it's not a Buddhist who are meditating on subtle impermanence in a sort of, you know, extremely acute way or something. It's not just those who realize that, but even people who never heard the Buddha's teachings, they can also be sensitive to that. Maybe not the animals, because their senses, their intelligence isn't so refined, but other thinking beings can work that one out, the unsatisfactory nature of samsaric happiness. But those two are not the ones that we need to realize. We need to meditate on subtle impermanence in order to understand. So that's why he says it's the third one, pervasive suffering or pervasive compositional suffering. That's the one that a proper understanding of subtle impermanence can lead you to understand. So we have those, that's a division of suffering into three then. Suffering of suffering, which he's calling the feeling of suffering, suffering with change, and you know, the suffering, pervasive compositional suffering. So it's all by way of, all in order to make us, you know, realize the sort of the unsatisfactory nature of samsara. So that's when we have to start thinking about the things that we might ordinarily be prepared to take as being pleasurable. We have to question them, say, are they really, you know, is this really the happiness, the satisfaction that, you know, is fulfilling? Is it really the happiness, the best that I'm capable of? Is it really something that I can put my trust on and depend upon in you know, my quest for happiness? So where's this, you know, time for a bit more meditation, really. So what we find in this life is, you know, this cycle of change is like kind of ends up being catastrophic all the time. So it ends up being, you know, disastrous. It ends up being, you know, like all our kind of aspirations and hopes get dashed. So it's like, where is the suffering coming from then? And then the message is, what's flung by karma and, you know, comes from affliction. That's the mental affliction of the afflicted states of mind. That's what affliction means in this sense. So from those two, then you're going to get, you know, the evolution of things that's sort of in their nature. Everything's going to be changing and, you know, interacting and being interdependent. But because there's, you know, contaminated karma and, you know, these afflicted states of mind somewhere in the game, somewhere in the causal complex, then whatever those evolutions of phenomena that are going on, they're always going to be sort of, you know, guaranteed to fall back into suffering. So whatever sort of happiness that they bring is always going to be temporary, and it can't sustain itself. because the, you know, the ripening up of those karmas is always going to be sort of a limited kind of happiness. So that's a problem, you see. So where's my definitions now? I'll just give you the definition of truth of suffering. Have you had a definition of the truth of suffering? Ye who like definitions? Some of you out there have practiced studying things with definitions. Maybe here. So that's the definition from Panchasana Rangpa, who's the textbook writer for Drepung Losaling Monastery, you see. So he says, okay, give us a definition of truth of suffering then. So that which has risen from its cause, truth of origins, and is... what should we say, Kauri Dupa, is included within cyclic existence. So that which is arisen from its origin, is that which is arisen from its cause, the truth of origins, and is included within cyclic existence. Okay. So then you want a definition of... truth of origins, truth of the cause of suffering, truth of origins sometimes translated. So that which produces its effect, the truth of suffering, that is included within cyclic existence. So that which is arisen from it, that which is produced from its effect, that which produces its effect, truth of suffering, and is included within cyclic existence. And then, so then you ask, well, what are those two origins? You know, what are they? What do you posit as the two origins? What do you posit as the origins of suffering? And then he says, if the origin of suffering is divided, there are two. There is the origin of suffering, which is the afflictions, and the origin of suffering, which is karma. So the two origins, which are the afflictions and true offerings, which true origins, which are karma. Mm-hmm. So, doesn't that includes pretty well everything in cyclic existence, doesn't it? So, what about something like the toast and marmalade that you had for breakfast then? We all like a bit of toast and marmalade in the morning. So is that suffering? So that's a question for you then. The toast and marmalade that you had for breakfast this morning, is should we regard that as suffering? So you can say, somebody can say, well, it is suffering because it's the truth of suffering. And it is the truth of suffering. It follows it is the truth of suffering because it arises from its cause, the truth of origins, and is included within cyclic existence. And then you say, well, what are those causes that you're talking about, the two origins? Well, karma and affliction. So is your toast and marmalade, does it fit into that bill?
No.
Buddhas eat toast, do they? The Buddhas eat toast. Well, that's a good point, yeah. If the toast of the Buddha's eating. Yes, that's a good question. Sorry, yeah.
Earlier on, in one of the commentary, somebody here was saying not to exchange pure or impure.
Yeah, grasping something to be impure, to be pure, is one of the four...
Well,
wrong.
Like grasping toast and marmalade to be pure be a cause of suffering when it's impure, being that it's impure?
Well, absolutely, yeah. I mean, that's a trivial example, but basically people are thinking like that, aren't they?
Yeah.
And, kind of, you know, grasping actions in the world, and that they're developing their attachments and their longings. They're really seeing that what they're after is something really worth having, as if it is pure, you know. That's by, you know, papering over their impurity side of it and just concentrating on the pleasant side of it. It's very...
you know, my guests, some toast and marmalade, might actually not be the cause of suffering because that isn't actually, you know, whereas perhaps sort of, you know, wanting it or enjoying it myself is.
Okay, well... Well, certainly somebody, you know,
who might need it.
Well, this is the question then. Is it suffering or not? So somebody can say, well, it is suffering because it is the truth of suffering. Go down that line. But somebody can say, no, it's not suffering because, you know, it's pleasurable. When you eat it, you enjoy the taste and it nourishes your body. So you've got these two ways you can go. So this is where we need the experts to come out and debate for us, and demonstration debate by the students in the class. Well, okay, so somebody can say yes. Eating the toast of marmalade is pleasurable. It's an object of pleasure. You eat it and it tastes good and it does you good. It's nourishing. So it's pleasurable. But you're still saying it's suffering then. But then you would have to say you're accepting it as pleasurable. So that it's pleasurable and it's suffering. You're saying it's both of those. Yeah, you'd think there'd be, it'd have to be one or the other, wouldn't you? That sounds profound. Yeah, so it could be pleasurable, or it could be suffering, or if you're really sophisticated like Stuart, it can be both. So which is it? Which are you going to choose? It's happiness, or it's suffering, or it's both? But besides, you know, no contradiction, it could be both. Well then, both in what sense, please? It's pleasurable because? Yeah, it satisfies people, it makes them happy and they eat it. Yeah. And then so then why is it suffering?
So suffering then is not pleasurable at all. Yeah. So what do you, which do you plump for then? This tosamala, it's superficially happy but pleasant, but it really is suffering. So actually, it's not happening. That's an illusion that it's happy. It's happy. It's pleasurable. Well, I've got my definition of suffering. And there are definitions of happiness, yeah. Happiness is a definition. I've got it from Alexander Berzin's website, but I don't think he kind of composed it, or he's got it from the Tibetan tradition. It doesn't actually say where he got it from. But that feeling, either mental or physical, which when it accompanies our experiencing things, we like it, or we want it to continue, or we want to meet it once more. So the object's pleasurable when it gives us that feeling. That feeling, either mental or physical, which, when it accompanies our experience of things, we like it. We want it to continue. We want to meet it once more. Well, that's a good question, good point, but, you know, the Dalai Lama often begins his Dharma talks by saying, yes, everybody's looking for happiness and everybody really wants to avoid suffering. And then somehow that's perfectly natural. You can analyse that and say, well, why did he want to have happiness? Why did he want to avoid suffering? But in the end, that's just the way we are. Once you've got a sentient being with a mind, then every experience is accompanied by a feeling. And so, naturally, the sentient being is going to seek the happy, seek happiness and avoid suffering. So that's not per se misguided thing to do. That's not per se attachment, is it? Because why do we want to achieve Buddhahood? Because we want to achieve happiness. We want to achieve happiness for as many people as possible. But liberation is just, we want happiness. But not all seeking of happiness is deluded, I don't think. Is it? Were you going to say something? Yeah, so there's moderate happiness without being attached, and that's how you avoid the worldly dharmas, isn't it? The happiness there means that you're attached to the happiness and, you know, averse to the suffering. Whereas the yogi, the practitioner, is saying, yeah, if it's happy, then it's happy, that's okay. And if it's suffering, then it's suffering, that's okay, you know, because that's the way cyclic existence is, you know. But the person who's becoming attached is then, you know, longing for it, seeing it is in a very pure way, you know. So seeing the object of desire papering over, you know, obscuring to themselves the impure aspects of the object of desire, and longing for it, longing the pleasure, hating to be separated from it, having, you know, invested it with more happiness potential than it's actually got. You know, sort of closing down the dependent arising, just having this will make me happy. Things are never so, you know, sort of single-minded in the way the cause produces the effect. Yeah, so this toast and marmalade then, is that suffering or not? You know, the way the Buddha's saying, you've got to be weary with happiness, what is it? Weary with happy feeling, weary with suffering feeling, weary with neutral feeling, become dispassionate. But I think we better have a cup of tea before we go on further, as well. Yeah.
And we can share
notes. Yeah, we take notes then, and we can really examine it with direct perception. please get a cup of tea if you... Well, that's a very good start. Yeah, that's this sort of the yogi, the practitioner's attitude, yeah. That you don't overbalance, that you don't sort of, you know, kind of a superimpose on all the impermanence that people do on things, don't they? You know, you buy a new car or something like that. It's so shiny and wonderful, but you know, after some days it gets scratched. So you get really upset that somebody scratched your beautiful car, but it's in the nature of the things that it's bound to, you know, have those. It's bound to get old like that. The people get so, they're sort of cut up, don't they? Whatever comes together must come apart, you know. But when somebody steals your precious possession, we get so kind of, you know, vicious, and you know, you'd like to think of all the nasty things you'd like to do to that person who stole your precious whatever it is. But everything that comes together will naturally come apart. Just everything in samsara is like that. Yeah, all that kind of thing. Right, cup of tea then. I'm not in meditation this session, but we had a discussion, so that's all right. Yes, please. So come back in about 15 minutes, 22.